Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. And by the way, if you are in the upstate New York area, Massachusetts, I'm going to be there this coming up weekend, June 17, 18, 19, at Kripalu, which is a retreat, beautiful retreat area in Massachusetts. I'm going to be doing a lecture with Dr. Bruce Lipton, who is the creator of epigenetics and a cellular biologist. We're going to be speaking about the cellular biology of perception and belief. So it's going to be a fascinating conversation where he will talk about the cellular structure and how it changes based on our beliefs and our perceptions. And I'll be guiding you through various practices and visualizations in order to start to work with making those changes in your brain and implementing them in your life. So it's going to be a great weekend. You can go to my website, which is theawareshow.com, and you can go to the events page and you will find out all about it there. Theawareshow.com/events, and you'll find out about that with Dr. Bruce Lipton and myself. All right, I will be right back with my next guest. We're talking about too much of a good thing when we come back. This is Lisa Gar, you're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. Now, over 200,000 years ago, what didn't kill us made us stronger. And our bodies changed and adapted over 10,000 generations. Now, fast forward to now. In the past 200 years, the Industrial Revolution has changed. And then in just these 200 years, our bodies have had to adapt in maybe 10 generations to this new world of the introduction of electricity and transportation and supermarkets and advancements in medicine. So our genes, our bodies are simply not able to adapt that fast to the changes that are happening in our world. My guest today is the Dean of Faculties of Health Sciences and Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center and an internationally renowned cardiologist, Dr. Lee Goldman. His latest book, Too Much of a Good Thing, outlines how four key survival traits are now killing us. Welcome to the show. I appreciate you being here, Dr. Goldman.
My pleasure.
Thank you. So, how did you discover these key four key survival traits that are responsible for 40%, did you say, of the deaths in the US?
Well, it's not so much I think that I discovered them as that I was able to hopefully write a book that puts them all into perspective because in reality, we've known for some time that the results of these, four mismatches, if you will, obesity, high blood pressure, depression and anxiety, and diseases of clotting, have been killing 40% of us. What the book really tries to do is to tie that together with, as you said, our genes and their inability to evolve at this rate of change in our external environment.
And let's talk about
we're
that.
still perfectly, configured to survive in the Paleolithic age, but we don't live in the Paleolithic age anymore.
So 200,000 years ago, we had our survival instincts were the exact opposite of what we need now. So we wanted to store fat. Let's talk about that.
Sure. In the very olden days, if you will, but really up to about 150 or 200 years ago, one of the biggest threats to survival of humans was starvation. You never knew where the next meal would be, and we are beautifully designed to be able to gorge when food is available and to store that excess as fat. And those of us who can do it the best are most likely to have ancestors who have survived through periods of starvation. And hence, we're the children of those people. The ancestors who couldn't do that, they died off, and they never had kids, or their kids died as well. So this trait, you evolved over time. The best way to look at this is that when we're given an excess of food to eat, we just keep on eating it. And the more diverse that food is, the more we love to eat. That's why we love buffets, for example. and our body very efficiently stores it as fat.
So we could potentially still be living as if there is no food around the corner.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what our genes tell us to do. That's what our
still.
So that's how we're, in essence, how we're programmed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Anybody who is able to step away from available food, they're fighting those genes every time they do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we also, because if we do step away from that food and diet, quote diet, our body then fights against us and says, oh, we need to store more fat because we need to go back into that survival mode.
Exactly right. If you try to diet, several things happen. One is that your brain tells you to eat more and you get hungrier.
Mm.
And that makes it extremely difficult to diet. But secondly, your metabolism actually changes. It slows down. You burn fewer calories for the same amount of activity. A great survival mechanism, after all, when our ancestors were faced with food shortages, was better if they were hungry all the time, so they were always seeking food. And if their metabolism could slow down so they wouldn't starve to death. We know from Irish hunger strikers during the time of conflict between Ireland and England that a perfectly healthy young man who eats nothing will die of starvation in about 8 to 9 weeks. That's assuming that you're able to get all the water you need, and those are people who basically were lying around in jail cells. If they'd been off hunting for food, they couldn't have lasted nearly that long.
Mm. Because they would have been eaten. They would have been food.
They would have been food. Well, mm-hmm. certainly, well, also, they would have burned more calories, but you're right. They mm-hmm. would have been very susceptible to all the predators that would have found them very tasty.
So now we have this excess fat issue where we have fat-laden foods and there are larger portions of foods and we have a obesity epidemic in this country where a third of the population is overweight. Is that correct?
Well, actually about two-thirds of the population is overweight.
Really?
A third is obese, which means they're well more than 20% overweight. But you're absolutely correct. Two things have happened. One is that we expend fewer calories. And it's not because Americans are less likely to go to gyms to work out. Probably more people do that than ever. It's that our daily lives don't require as much caloric expenditure. So very few people work in jobs that require mm-hmm. lots of physical activity. Even as they say, our kids no longer walk uphill to school both ways. We consume far less calories, which we burn far less calories in our daily work. And secondly, food is just so much more available than it was before. And it's available in large portions and also in formulations that are simply laden, as you said, with sugar, salt, which we'll get to later, and fat. A couple of examples. I'm old enough to remember when ice cream was a delicacy, and now it's like a basic food group. We sort of just take for granted that ice cream, donuts, cake, and all those sweet things will be available all the time. And another way to think about this is that we're not that much different than those animals in a zoo. You put an animal in the wild and it doesn't get fat. It exercises enough that it's able to titrate what it eats more or less to the amount of exercise it does.
Mm.
It'll still gorge when food's available. I mean, a lion gorges when it kills that elk, but it doesn't get fat in the wild like it does in the zoo, where it just doesn't have enough activity to be able to balance its physical activity with its food intake. We're really no different, in the modern world, if you will, than what you see when you put an animal in a zoo.
Interesting. So then we have this constant availability of food as we would need it. I mean, you can, convenience stores or our food is processed, secondly, we have lifestyles where we're definitely more sedentary. We could work out all we want, but then our daily jobs and lifestyles require sitting. And if you're, you know, driving, if you're working in an office and so forth, unless you're in construction or something more physical. So all of this is flipping the switch of what we originally, our DNA had been conditioned to now, with a very short period of time, this contributes to the obesity epidemic in our country.
Yep.
So
another way of, let me put, there's another sort of dynamic here to keep in mind, which is that we like certain kinds of food, mostly because of our taste buds. I mean, our brains make us hungry, but our taste buds help drive what we want to eat. And we like sugar and anything that's sweet. We tend to like things that are salty. We like things that have what's called sort of a protein taste, umami, like MSG. Those are things that we like. We generally don't like bitter and sour. Now, we can learn to like those things, but historically, we don't like those things because sour foods oftentimes are spoiled and you get sick from them, and bitter is the taste of many things that are poisonous. So we can learn to like those things, but generally, our taste buds push us toward sugar, protein. We also like the smoothness, if we will, of things that are fatty. And based on those taste buds, we get all the things we need to eat. We don't really have an internal desire to get enough vitamin D or to get enough vitamin C. In fact, scurvy, which the British sailors used to die from when they were off on ships for months, they never sat there saying, gee, I really wish I had a lemon.
Right.
Or a lime. That's what cured scurvy. But it's not that we have some innate desire to eat citrus fruits so we don't die of vitamin C deficiency. We get all the vitamins we need because we love diversity in our food supply. And so given the choice between eating a lot of one thing versus sampling in a buffet, we'll always choose to sample at a buffet. And that's why some popular diets work by limiting your diversity of food intake. The Atkins diet works largely because if you say to someone, you can eat all the steak and bacon you want, sooner or later you just don't really want to eat any more steak
mm-hmm.
and bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you may lose weight just because the diet is boring. It's hard to stay on it because it's boring, but that's more or less what makes it work. And I cite in the book one of the great examples of this. First, can we all agree that every colored M&M tastes the same?
Yes.
Brown M&Ms taste the same as yellow M&Ms,
yes.
Taste the same as green M&Ms. They all taste exactly the same. But if you give 10 people M&Ms of one color and give 10 other people M&Ms of varying colors, the people given the M&Ms of varying colors will routinely eat 20 to 40% more M&Ms.
Wow.
Because their brains somehow just think this is diversity, even though they all taste exactly the same. And that's one of the great experiments that proves this fact that the more diverse the food, the more we eat. Well, the availability of diverse food has never been like it is now.
Right.
We don't find ourselves faced with, you know, a meal made up of one kind of nuts or one kind of berries or, you know, all the deer you can eat. We have access to such a variety of foods that it alone stimulates us to eat more. And as I said, that was a great survival trait. That drive for diversity helped us get all those things we needed in our diet, all those essential vitamins and minerals. Now we have no problem getting that because, my goodness, we eat pretty much everything.
But wouldn't you think that we would, as 200,000 years ago, only eat the fruits and vegetables and proteins within the area that we lived?
That's right. That's all we had access to.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty boring.
But we craved diversity.
But we still when there was a feast, people ate a lot. And as I say in the book, if you had your choice as to what you would eat, you would eat a whole animal. I mean, as that, by that I mean the entire animal. The meat, all the organs, the brain, you gnaw on the bones. And if you eat an entire animal, you get everything you need. And in fact, there's an experiment of a couple of scientists from Scandinavia who did that for a year. They ate nothing but whole animals, and they did just fine. It's much harder to try to do this without eating meat, without eating the animal. If you want to do that, believe it or not, probably the best all-around food is a potato. For those of you who've watched the movie The Martian, it's not by chance that he makes
Oh,
it
grilled
through more than a
potatoes.
year just eating potatoes. Potatoes have pretty much everything you need. They don't have, they're short on vitamin D. And that's why back in the mid-19th century in Ireland, where people lived mainly off of potatoes, in fact, they could live 25 potatoes a day is a pretty decent diet. They also drank milk, and that's how they got their vitamin D. But The Martian is interesting. They don't really talk about it, in the movie, but the potato was the closest thing we have probably to a perfect food.
Really? I thought it was the avocado.
Avocado, you live in California. Avocado's not bad.
That's right. So we've covered one of the traits here, but how do you then teach your body that it doesn't need this excess food in order to survive any longer and be and have any control over something like that?
Well, if I had the answer to that, two-thirds of Americans wouldn't be overweight, one-third of them would be obese, and obesity wouldn't be rising all across the world.
And diabetes.
And one of the major side effects of obesity is that it makes people more likely to have diabetes. And just for your listeners, I'm sure you know this, there are two kinds of diabetes called, not very imaginatively, type 1 and type 2. The type 1 is what's called an autoimmune disease. You have really no control over that as best as we can tell. Its frequency may be increasing a little bit. It usually appears in children or adolescents, sometimes in young adults. But the real epidemic is in what's called type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is driven overwhelmingly by obesity, the increase in storage of fat, which leads to an inability of one's normal or even increased insulin level, which is what's missing in type 1 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, people start off with plenty of insulin, but it's still not enough, in part because they become resistant to insulin. And occasionally, their pancreases, which makes the insulin, actually burn out over time, and their insulin levels become low. But for most of the time, they have diabetes despite high insulin levels. The complications in the two turn out to be pretty much the same. So diabetes is a real problem. Right now, between 10 and 15% of Americans have diabetes, overwhelmingly driven by obesity.
And so you were saying that is there a possibility of reshaping our genetics through thought and basically convincing ourselves through generation after generation that we're in right now that we can live with less food?
Well, we can come back to that because that really applies to all four of the
Okay.
traits I talk about in the book.
Okay.
But I guess I would say two things. One, our basic genome can't possibly change like that. And what drives evolution, changes in our genes, is what's called natural selection. That people who have genes that make them more fit for their environment survive and have children, and people whose genes make them less fit die or don't have children who make it and perpetuate the species.
We're going to have to continue that conversation after this break, but natural selection. We will be right back with Lee Goldman. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I just want to make a couple of announcements here about some events that are coming up with your favorite, George Norrie. George is going to be in St. Louis live in Asheville. If you go to the website, thecoasttocoastam.com, if you can go to coasttocoastam.com/pages/events, you can find out about the St. Louis events coming up in June on the 18th. And it's live streaming also. So if you can't get there in person, there's a way on there that you could click for details on the live streaming event as well. Also, you can find out more information about ParanormalDate.com, ParanormalDate.com, approaching 47,000 members, which is wonderful. You can use a promo code there, which is SUMMER. And also, BeyondBelief.com, George has a show on the Gaia TV network, and I do as well, at Lisa'sInspirations.com. You could check out George's show, great, great show that he's got there, called Beyond Belief. And I also have one called Lisa's Inspirations. We're both on the Gaia Network, and we'd love you to check out our shows there as well. So check all those things out during the next break, and I will be back with my guest, Dr. Lee Goldman. When we come back, this is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is Dr. Lee Goldman, and he is the Dean of the Faculties of Health Sciences and Medicine at Columbia University Medical Center, and also an internationally renowned cardiologist. His latest book, Too Much of a Good Thing, outlines four key survival traits that directly cause now more than 40% of the deaths in the United States. We just covered one of them, our appetite and the ability to store excess calories as fat. So our craving for our high-fat foods were really based on ancient DNA. Now that this is no longer the case and food is readily available, to switch off those genes is something that we have to be conscious of. Another thing is the need for salt and water. At one point, our ancestors craved salt to avoid dehydration, and now it's causing high blood pressure. Can you talk a little bit about that, Dr. Goldman?
Not only our ancestors crave salt, we still crave salt.
Yes.
As I was saying before, the things our taste buds really urge us to eat include things that are sweet, things that are salty, and things with high protein content. The way I try to describe this in the book to give a sense of the importance of salt is to say that one of the survival advantages that it's thought that humans have had for a long time is our endurance. We're not the fastest animal, but we can run farther and longer than essentially any other animal, especially when it's hot. In fact, each year in Wales, there's a race, a human versus horses, over a marathon distance. And as you expect, horses usually win, except if it's really hot. Because if it's really hot, a horse can't sweat enough to have the evaporation of that sweat keep its body temperature from rising. We know that horses get frothy mm-hmm. when they get hot, but the sweat that they have is very thick. They don't get rid of a lot of water, and it's the evaporation of the water from the skin that lowers your temperature. Humans are the best of any animals at doing that. In the book, I talk about the comparison between a human and a cheetah. A cheetah is the fastest animal sprinting, far faster than we can sprint. But interestingly, if you put a cheetah on a treadmill with a rectal thermometer, and someone actually did this, the cheetah will sprint for about a mile or a mile and a half, but its temperature will rise to 107 degrees. It'll lie down on the treadmill and just sort of roll off. Because at 107 degrees, it's become overheated. You just can't keep on going. By comparison, as long as we have access to water, we can keep on sweating and keep our temperature from rising. Cheetahs, even if they wanted to, can't sweat, except through their paws, really. Most animals, like dogs, if you watch a dog that exercises, it gets rid of most of its heat by breathing rapidly. That's a very inefficient way of getting rid of heat. So we're terrific at this. But in order to do it, we have to have enough water and corresponding salt so you don't get dehydrated. Because if you get dehydrated, your blood pressure falls, ultimately your temperature rises, you get heat stroke, you get dizzy, you faint, and you die. So to offset this risk, we had to be really good at craving salt, and we had to be able to find water as well. The need for water is why essentially all civilizations arose along rivers and other sources of fresh water, why the Romans were so good at building aqueducts to get to their cities. But they also needed salt. And in fact, it's an interesting derivation, that word salt. It comes from the Roman word for sal, which is the Roman or Latin for salt. That's also the derivation of the word salary, because Roman soldiers, they weren't paid typically in gold. They didn't have paper money back then. They were paid, believe it or not, in salt. Salt, for most of human existence, was more valuable than gold, because salt kept you alive. And it was a tradable commodity. There's a terrific book entitled Salt I encourage people to read. So that desire for salt, that need for salt, really was critical for human survival. And today, again, we are the descendants of people who were really good at craving salt and getting salt. If you didn't have that instinct for salt, you didn't survive, and you don't have kids who are here now many, many generations later. So this is hardwired into our genes and into our preferences. It's why people love salty foods, and it's why people, when salt's available, consume probably two or three times as much salt as we really need.
Ah, so now if you consume too much salt, then how does that lead to high blood pressure?
So if we consume salt, especially excess salt, we need to hold on to some water as well. Otherwise, our bodies get too salty. And we have very finely tuned thermostats, in essence, in our body that try to balance the amount of salt and water. And so you eat too much salt, you tend to hold on to some extra water that increases the volume of your blood, and it leads through a variety of hormones to a subtle but real increase in your blood pressure. So the more salt you take in, the somewhat higher your blood pressure becomes. And over time, the response of your arteries to that excess salt and water and slightly increased blood pressure is to become thickened, and that thickening of the arteries makes your heart have to pump harder and raises your blood pressure yet more. In most Western cultures, our blood pressures gradually rise with age. And the older we get, the higher our blood pressures become. In cultures where salt intake is far lower than ours, blood pressures don't rise with age. They stay low, and high blood pressure is not a problem. Today in the world, the best estimates are that high blood pressure kills more people than starvation. We talked before about the need for food. That gives you some sense of how the tables have turned.
Right.
You know, we crave food, we crave salt, and now we're at a point where
obese, and we have high blood pressure.
And hypertension. But high blood pressure alone, not even counting the obesity, high blood pressure alone kills more people than starvation. So it gives you a sense here of how these traits that were so critical for our ancestors, and now deeply embedded in our genes, are really badly mismatched for the challenges we currently face.
Thus, the too much of a good thing.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Another trait is fear and violence, and that is very interesting based on tonight's news. We have...
Yes, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that... some of the things when I started writing the book I knew about, and others I learned a lot more as I wrote the book and did the research behind it. And one of those was really getting a sense for the history of violence. And it turns out that people who've looked at the skeletal remains of people from the Paleolithic era, the Stone Age in essence, estimate that about 15% of those bodies, those skeletons, show evidence of very major and probably fatal trauma. Most of that trauma appears to be head trauma, and the most common kind of head trauma is a skull fracture in the left side of your skull. And the most likely explanation for that is that some right-handed person smashed you in the head.
Okay.
Now, clearly some people fell off of cliffs and things of that sort. But people killed each other. And as best we can tell from groups of humans who've been isolated from civilization and who've been found, if you will, and whose behaviors have been tracked, you know, people fight over all sorts of things. They fight over food, they fight over mates, they fight over supremacy. Most of the murder is done by men. Men kill each other, but they also kill women. And they especially kill women if they're afraid they're going to lose them. Interestingly, the so-called Neolithic age, which is the beginning of farming, and I'll talk more about that later, when people settled down about 10,000 years ago, domesticated animals began to farm, skeletal remains suggest things got even worse. About 25% of people's skeletons show evidence of major trauma. The best explanation for this is that there was even more to fight over now that you had farms and animals. So really a very, very violent heritage here.
Mm.
Murder doesn't really begin to decline until probably the Middle Ages, the advent of chivalry, the belief that...
Really? That's it?
that was very helpful, believe it or not.
Huh.
And the beginning, somewhat later on, of the concept that a murder is a crime against the state rather than something for which your family must seek revenge.
Okay.
So the Hatfields and McCoys that we talk about are really symbolic of what justice, if you will, and revenge were all about. Someone killed someone in your family, you went and killed them. And that just kept on escalating until no one was left. So that's what our ancestors faced. They also faced, obviously, a lot of physical challenges. Cliffs, animals.
Fight or flight.
Spiders. And the so-called fight or flight reflex comes from that. There is also, I'll come back to that in a moment, just some of the things that we're afraid of, in addition to potentially other people. We as humans are naturally afraid of snakes and spiders. If you show people pictures of snakes or spiders under controlled experiments, you can show that your pulse will go up, your fear instinct will be activated.
Because they used to kill us, right?
They used to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
That's
in our DNA.
Protective back then. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's interesting. If you do that with little kids, they're still afraid of snakes and spiders. They're not afraid of guns. They're not afraid of cars.
Mm-hmm.
What kills little kids these days are cars and guns, not snakes and spiders.
Mm.
So this is an example of what's hardwired versus what's not. How do we avoid getting killed, whether it's snakes and spiders or other people? Well, the fight or flight response you talked about was critically important. Flight, you know, being aware, being anxious, nervous, and sensing something early so you could run away before you got killed was obviously very helpful. But there is at least a third response, and that was to become submissive, to cower in fear, to freeze, and hope you didn't get killed. And you still see that, for example, what does a dog do when it loses a fight? Tail between its legs, it slinks off very passively, it hopes you don't hit it or hurt it. And that's another response that humans as well have. When faced with a foe that you can't beat. If you can't win the fight, and you're not going to be able to run away, the third option is just cower in fear and hope the bullet doesn't hit you too hard.
And that is even worse.
Well, it's again, that reaction can save you. And in that regard, it's an evolutionarily useful reaction. But what that really is the predecessor to depression. So that
okay.
cowering, that submission,
mm-hmm.
that give up, is very adaptive and very helpful if it's temporary. And you go off, slink off, recoup, come back and fight another day. But if you don't rebound, that's what we call depression. And as best as we can tell, evolutionary psychiatry would suggest that that in many ways is the reason for depression. People also can get depressed and even commit suicide when they think that they are a burden on
Other
the rest
people.
Of the group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Most suicides, you know, come from people who are depressed, and this isn't, you know, it's the downside of whatever otherwise would be considered to be a beneficial evolutionary response. Amazingly, I talked about chivalry and justice,
mm-hmm.
And even with today's, you know, awful events, and even with the wars that we still have, if you do the arithmetic, and I know this will sound crazy to some of your listeners, we've never lived in a safer time.
Yeah, it does sound crazy.
The percent of humans who get killed by war and murder is lower than it's ever been. In fact, in America today, each year more people die of suicide than get murdered or die in all the wars put together. That's hard to believe, and today was just an awful day. 50 people last I saw killed in that terrible event in Orlando. And I'm not trying to minimize that in any way. I'm just trying to say that just keep in mind that more people die from suicide than from all of murder and war put together. In fact, even with guns, more people die each year from suicide gunshots, kill themselves with guns, than die from murders with guns. So that gives you an example of how much this has flipped. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be cautious and wary and, you know, that there aren't dangers out there. I'm just trying to say that the evolutionary balance, it's really, really remarkable.
But you can't say that more people died from suicide and accidental gun murder than died from prehistoric dangers, such as predators and plague.
Not like, so again, if 25% of people in the, you know, early farming era were dying of murder and injuries, we're nowhere near that in terms of suicide.
Right.
So these protective traits were critical. We are the descendants of people who did the killing, not the people who got killed.
We're the ones who survived.
Mm-hmm. Right, we're the ones who survived.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very good evidence that even the most passive, if you will, of us could get very violent if, you know, we or our families were directly threatened. These are, you know, survival traits. What I'm saying is that though imperfect, you know, the legal system, civilization, actually does work. And as civilization has taken hold, people are much less likely to kill each other. You're more likely to sue someone than to kill them. That doesn't mean that that always happens. And I said yesterday's events were just horrific. But on average, numerically, people are more likely to kill themselves than get killed by somebody else. And if you have a gun in your house, it's more likely to result in suicide than in anything else.
In getting killed. I mean, then even accidents and so forth. That is amazing. So how could that... So you're saying too much of a good thing.
I'm saying that, you know, too much of a good thing here is how we flipped from people getting killed by
predators,
snakes,
mm-hmm.
spiders, saber-toothed lions, falling off of cliffs, and getting killed by other people, to now you're more likely to commit suicide.
Mm. Wow. Because of depression, anxiety, PTSD, all of the things that Americans struggle with today.
You got it. Pretty
fascinating.
Amazing.
All right, we're going to come back and continue this conversation. We're going to get to a solution here of what, how we can actually bring awareness about these four key traits and make some changes. So we will be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.